Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. L.A. Congressman Adam Schiff tells us what he hopes to get out of upcoming testimony by former special counsel Robert Mueller on Russian interference in U.S. elections. Plus, how U.S.-China tensions have created visa headaches for some Chinese students at California universities. It's all ahead on Take Two.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights. 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. Happy Monday to you. Coming up, we'll look at what's shaping up to be one of the best crosstown sports rivalries right now between Major League Soccer teams, LAFC, and the Galaxy. More on El Trafico in about 15 minutes. Plus, we're going to speak with the author of a new true crime book all about LA's own Bonnie and Clyde.
Over the course of about 5 weeks, they were not robbing banks. They were robbing ordinary people, and there was no rhyme or reason to it.
Find out more about the blonde rattlesnake later in today's show. But we start with an eye on Washington. Former special counsel Robert Mueller will testify in front of the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees this Wednesday. The five-hour testimony will likely focus on his 448-page report released back in April. But it's anyone's guess whether the day will yield any new information, and Democrats and Republicans are managing their expectations. Still, it marks a symbolic turning point for both major parties. The outcome could determine the direction of the political winds ahead of elections next year. Los Angeles Congressman and House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff will be there for Robert Mueller's testimony. Earlier, he told me what he hopes to ask during that closely watched hearing.
Well, the special counsel is, first of all, very reluctant witness. He doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want to testify. We had to compel his attendance. And he's made it clear that he does not want to go beyond the report. Now, that's a choice that he's making, but we'll have to decide with the limited time we have, and between our two committees, we'll have him for about 5 hours, whether we want to spend that time fighting with him to go outside the report, or instead working through his testimony to reveal much of what the public still doesn't understand, because most Americans don't have the opportunity to read a lengthy prosecutorial document like the Mueller report. So we want to go through each of the stages of Russian intervention, how the Trump campaign reacted, how they made use of this, how they sought to cover it up, how they sought to obstruct the investigation into this foreign interference. It's a story that has been, I think, concealed by a lot of misrepresentations coming out of the White House and from the Attorney General himself. So this is the first time the public will actually hear it from the man who did the investigation.
But as you were just saying, Congressman, Robert Mueller is very reluctant to say anything beyond what's in the report. Will you be disappointed or worried if he doesn't offer up anything new to the public?
I don't expect that he's going to offer anything new that people would consider some kind of a bombshell. The bombshells are already in public view, in my opinion. So there's plenty, I think, that will be surprising to the public just because it's so little understood what's in that lengthy report. But I don't think we should go into it thinking there's going to be some new revelation. And I also think we have to be realistic that many Americans have their views on Trump and Russia pretty heavily dug in at this point. If the appalling performance of the president and the crowd that was chanting that racist chant isn't enough to change attitudes about Donald Trump, then I don't know whether anything Bob Mueller has to say will do so either. But nonetheless, I think it's important that these facts come out because part of the mission here is to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, and as you know all too well, the Mueller investigation has been highly politicized. Republicans pounced on Mueller's finding that members of the Trump campaign did not conspire with the Russian government. Mueller also did not conclude that the president committed obstruction of justice. Republicans have called this an exoneration. If Robert Mueller offers nothing new Wednesday, are you concerned that the Republicans could weaponize this in future elections against Democrats in swing districts in particular?
Well, I think Mueller will rebut a lot of those false claims by the Republicans. He won't do it necessarily by saying the Republicans don't know what they're talking about. But when he's asked, he will make it clear that, for example, when they say that the report exonerated the president, he'll say, that's not what we wrote in the report. In fact, we wrote we could not exonerate the president. And if they try to make the argument, your report found no conclusion, he will respond, presumably by saying, that's not what my report says either. In fact, we didn't analyze the question of collusion, which is both criminal and non-criminal conduct. So I think he will offer a powerful rebuttal to these talking points from the president, this no collusion, no obstruction. What I expect, frankly, from the GOP is much more of the conspiracy, you know, line of thinking that we shouldn't be concerned about the Russians interfering in our election. That's not the real crime here, or the Trump campaign making use of Russian help. No, the crime is that this was investigated at all.
If you're just joining us now, I'm talking about upcoming testimony by Special Counsel Robert Mueller with LA Congressman and Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff. You said in a recent interview on a podcast for Vox that neither tech companies nor the government are prepared to battle foreign election interference next year. There's been so much made of the investigation into 2016, but it sounds like we're sailing into another election underprepared. Is the political nature of Mueller's investigation impeding progress on this front in Washington?
Well, I think what's really impeded progress on this front is that efforts to secure our elections, efforts to analyze what the Russians did in 2016, what they did in 2018, what they may very well do in 2020, are met with resistance by the president, who feels that it's all a threat to the legitimacy of his election. Apart from that, I think we in Congress, and indeed in the individual agencies and in the intelligence community, we are doing what we can to prepare. But I don't think we're there yet by any means. And, you know, one of the new technologies that most concerns me is what's called deepfake technology that allows you to produce a compelling and virtually indistinguishable from real, yet utterly fraudulent video or audio of someone. I don't think we have to expect or should expect that the Russians are going to intervene in precisely the way they did 4 years earlier. If they release into the wild of the social media ecosystem a fraudulent video 2 or 3 weeks before the election that has a candidate saying something incendiary, it could literally alter the course of history.
Mm. Now, you do have bills before Congress that would try to tighten election security through sending $1 billion to state and local governments. Another one would streamline communications between the federal government and states. When it comes to these election security bills, though, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he's been called a one-man roadblock. What is it going to take to depoliticize this issue of election security? And do you think the Mueller testimony will help with that?
It's a very good question. On this topic, and frankly the great many others, Mitch McConnell has, with great pride, declared himself the Grim Reaper or the Crypt Keeper who kills everything that comes over from the House. It's certainly a tremendous disservice to our democracy when bills that would bolster election security are killed in the Senate. I think it is negligence on its face in this day and age for any state or any locality to fail to have a paper trail for their voting technology. And there are still key jurisdictions and key swing states that don't have a paper trail. We should be requiring that. We should be helping the states with funding to be able to acquire and make use of those technologies. Some jurisdictions are using technologies that they don't have the resources to update the software, which means that they're even more vulnerable. And for anyone to stand in the way, I think, is appalling. And I don't know that the hearing changes that calculus, because I don't understand the calculus to begin with, but we're going to keep all the pressure on we can to protect the sanctity of our franchise. But it's certainly true that we're not getting the help on the other side of the Capitol and from the other party that we should.
All right, L.A. Congressman Adam Schiff chairs the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Schiff, thank you for making the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And KPCC will carry Robert Mueller's testimony live when it happens. Coverage from NPR will start Wednesday morning at 5:30 here on 89.3 or online at kpcc.org. Staying with national politics now, let's look at some of its local ripple effects. Trade tensions between the U.S. and China have generated a lot of volatility in both countries, and that's having a major effect on universities throughout the state. Many of them report that Chinese students and scholars are facing visa delays and increased federal scrutiny over their research. There are also new restrictions on American universities collaborating with Chinese institutions. Joining us now is Teresa Watanabe, staff writer at the LA Times. She's been following this story. Teresa, it's really good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Can you lay this out for us? What exactly are federal officials concerned about when it comes to Chinese scholars?
Well, federal officials are increasingly concerned that China is exploiting the U.S. open academic environment to steal intellectual property and innovations. And so they've really been cracking down in recent years.
And how are the California universities reacting to all this heightened scrutiny about their Chinese grad students?
There is a huge amount of concern throughout the system, especially at the University of California. The National Institutes of Health, for instance, sent letters to 61 institutions across the country, and that included UC campuses at LA, Berkeley, Riverside, San Francisco, and San Diego, raising questions about some of their researchers and whether they have properly disclosed all of their outside funding and contacts. And they're also really concerned about whether their scholars can continue to participate in Chinese talent recruitment programs, and even whether they're going to be allowed to continue accepting Chinese graduate students for their research laboratories because of the visa problems.
How important are these Chinese students to these different research labs and projects? Are there other scholars from other countries or even from the states who could potentially fill any vacuum?
Well, a lot of the laboratories I visited, very interesting. They're highly international, and there are scholars from all over the world in these UC labs. But the Chinese researchers do play a critical role. And I interviewed an expert, Susan Shirk, at the UC San Diego campus. She says that the Chinese researchers are, quote, irreplaceable because America's education system simply is not producing the number of engineers and other STEM majors that the nation needs.
If you're just joining us now, we're speaking with LA Times reporter Teresa Watanabe. Teresa, earlier today, I spoke with David Terrell, who's a professor of chemistry and chemical engineering and provost at the California Institute of Technology. And I asked him what kind of concerns he was hearing from students and staff on campus. And this is what he had to say.
I think there are two kinds of concerns, the personal and the broader scientific concerns. The personal ones about being able to come and go from the U.S. Anxiety that's reached the level where students are saying that they won't leave the country to visit home until they complete their degrees because they're concerned that they won't be able to return. And then the broader concerns, I think the importance of continuing to attract the very best people from around the world, the most talented people, irrespective of where they come from.
Teresa, have you heard these concerns before from other academics? I mean, what is leadership saying at the UCs and other campuses across California?
Absolutely. I have heard these concerns. I was interviewing, for instance, a UC Davis postdoc researcher from China. And he was saying that he doesn't dare leave the country. In fact, he had to decline an invitation to an international conference this year because he was so scared that he wouldn't be able to get back into the country. And he recently attended a University of Arizona conference. He said he was shocked to see that several Chinese scholars who were supposed to speak had to cancel out because they couldn't get the visas in time. And so what's happening is that a lot of scholars are very concerned, as the Caltech provost said, both on a personal level, but also the impact that this will have on U.S. innovation and research. We had a a companion story today on racial profiling fears among Chinese scholars. And what I there was one example given where we're losing some of the best talent, and specifically mentioned was a top climate scientist who essentially left and went back to China because of all of the problems here.
And now, to be clear, the NIH, the feds are saying they're looking at behavior, not individuals. But it sounds like from your reporting that these Chinese Americans who are working in the U.S. feel like they are being racially profiled. You spoke with, you mentioned some of these academics, these scholars. How are they feeling, like, anxiety-wise under all this extra scrutiny?
They're just feeling very, very stressed. I spoke to a UCLA doctoral student. He actually just graduated, and I was just emailing with him the other day, and he said he still is waiting for his visa. It's been 3 months. He said he's completely stressed out. He doesn't know if he can continue his research. And this is a scholar who is really helping advance robotic exoskeletons that help stroke victims regain their neural connections. I mean, this is really important, valuable research they're doing, and so many of them are completely uncertain and stressed out about their future.
And so what can he do right now? Is he he's continuing to work and do his research?
He graduated, and he did get a job at a local robotics company, but whether he can get his working visa in time or not is up in the air, because as of a few days ago, he said he's still waiting.
All right. That's Teresa Watanabe, staff writer at the LA Times, who covers education. Thank you for this update.
Thank you.
Coming up on Take Two, we are going to talk about one of the most exciting crosstown rivalries right now in all of sports. It's right here in LA happening. Right here, it even has a name, El Tráfico. Also, coming up, a heads up, the DMV is going to be closed part of the day Wednesday, and you may be asking, what's up with that? Well, it's part of a fix to a rollout of a program that's been bungled, and it's not the only thing that needs a fix. Wait times are incredibly long. That's being looked at, too. Stay with us for more about this on Take Two. And you're back with Take Two. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Last Friday night, the atmosphere was electric at Dignity Health Sports Park in Carson, in what's shaping up to be one of the best crosstown sports rivalries right now.
So seatbelts fastened for the fourth edition of El Tráfico.
That's the name for matches between LA's two major league soccer teams, LAFC and the LA Galaxy. It's particularly intense at the moment because the teams are 1-2, respectively, in the Western Conference. But on Friday, the Galaxy pulled out a 3-2 win.
There's the whistle. LAFC, the leaders, have been flattened.
To find out how this rivalry grew so fast, we have Helene Elliott. She's been chronicling the intense competition between the teams. She's a sports columnist for the LA Times. Helene, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
I want to get to the name of this rivalry in just a minute, but first tell us about how it got started. I mean, LAFC did not even exist 2 years ago. How did El Tráfico escalate so quickly?
Well, one thing that I've learned over the years in covering soccer is just the passion that so many supporters have for their teams. I think even in the United States, where soccer is not as popular and as well watched as it is in European countries or South America or Asia, just the passion that's involved and the loyalty on the part of fans, it's just really astonishing to watch. And you go to so many sports events and the scoreboard or an announcer will say, you know, clap your hands or cheer or whatever. Soccer fans do it on their own. Soccer fans generate their own chants, and the drum beating and the singing and the swaying and some very clever chants. chants, particularly at the end the other night when Galaxy fans were chanting, "You can't beat us," and they were absolutely right. Just the energy at those matches is just so much fun, and I think it comes from people just living through their loyalties. They choose a side. They're going to be Galaxy fans. Other people gravitated to the new team, to LAFC, and the remarkable success that it's been having. And it was just a great spectacle the other night. It really was.
Sounds like there are clever cheers. What about this name, pretty clever-sounding name, El Trafico? Is this a joke about bad crosstown traffic?
A little bit, yes. In case you haven't noticed, we tend to have bad traffic here. But it's kind of a play on the El Clasico, which is the nickname given to traditional rivalries among teams in Europe or South America, crosstown rivalries. And I think it's very clever, and it certainly fits. And it helps create this festive atmosphere and make it part of kind of an in-joke that everybody in Southern California can understand. We've all lived it, but now we can all kind of laugh at it, too.
Well, a lot of the excitement around the rivalry seems to be driven by a player on the Galaxy whose name is Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He's definitely a showman who calls himself a Ferrari among Fiats. Here he is talking to Jimmy Kimmel last year about the impact he's had on soccer in L.A.
I mean, I had a vision before I come. I said, when I come, and I know there is some earthquakes in Los Angeles, but this one was me stepping in Los Angeles, so.
Helene, he talks big, right? But
he backs it up.
Okay,
exactly.
who is this guy?
If an athlete is boastful and doesn't back it up, but this guy does. And, I mean, the hat trick he scored, the three goals he scored, one was with his left foot, one was with his right foot, and one was with his head.
Because he scored all three goals for Galaxy, the Galaxy on Friday, right? Okay.
Yeah, and just shows his versatility, his impact. There are some athletes who thrive under pressure. They crave the spotlight. They want the ball. They want to be the guy who's called upon in the most crucial moment of a game or a playoff series. He's one of those people, and he consistently delivers.
Is the cocky persona an act?
A little bit, and you know what? Good for him. I think that's one thing, too. We need personalities in sports. I think particularly a sport like soccer, a league like MLS, which is still trying to win over fans, which is still trying to make an impact. There's just so many major leagues and so many major league teams in L.A., plus the college teams. I mean, you've got two baseball teams, two basketball teams, two hockey teams. You've got USC, you've got UCLA. In order to stand out in L.A., you have to win, and you have to win with some personality. Mm-hmm. And he's been able to do that.
If you're just joining us now, we're speaking with Helene Elliott, who's a sports columnist for the L.A. Times. LAFC has its own star, Carlos Vela, who seems by comparison to be much more understated. But he's likely to be named the league's MVP, right?
Exactly. And Zlatan had the greatest comeback. Somebody asked him after the game last week, talked about Vela, and Zlatan pretended to be very upset, offended, do not compare us. I am better. Do not compare us. You are insulting me with this comparison. Uh-huh. But again, I can see where it might strike some people the wrong way, but he delivers. And again, that personality, you have to give people in LA a compelling reason to go to a sporting event. And knowing that Ibrahimovic is going to score goals or be involved in big plays, he's going to play up to the fans, he's going to be somebody who you can count on in tense moments, that sells the game.
Mm-hmm. Helene, we just have a little bit under a minute left. What has this rivalry done for soccer in L.A.?
I think it's really raised the level of consciousness about soccer here. I think it's probably brought in fans who might not have wanted to go to games or thought about going to games before. The level of play in that game was just absolutely outstanding. The level of play has gotten better, I think, in the league every year. And when you have the attraction of people like Vela and Ibrahimovic and so many others, it really makes it a worthwhile place to spend a few hours.
I got to get myself to a match. Helene Elliott is a sports columnist for the LA Times. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This Wednesday, DMV offices around California will close for half a day. Workers will spend that time being trained on the federally mandated Real ID program. That's the one where Californians need to get a new driver's license or ID card by fall of 2020 if they want to use it for flying or entering federal facilities. But its rollout in the state has been marked by problems. Then there's the issue of the other troubled DMV program, Motor Voter. All in all, it's been a really rocky road for the department in the past year. To get us up to speed, we have Brian Anderson, who's political reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Josie. Pleasure to be here.
Brian, it's a long-running joke that the DMV is a small circle of hell on Earth. But let's start with Real ID, which people started applying for in January of 2018. How has the department fumbled in issuing those new cards?
Oh, where to start? I'd say that the Real ID program was in response to a federally mandated requirement, and that's a key context. This is California and other states reacting to a federal requirement. And shortly after, there was a bunch of people who came into these DMV offices for these special cards. Now, if you want to go to an airport starting October 1st, 2020, without having to lug your passport around and you just want your driver's license, you're going to need this Real ID card. So as customers were coming in for this special ID card, one issue that emerged was that people had provided one form of residency rather than two that the federal government had required. So California sent 3.6 million letters out to customers informing them of this mistake, and both the federal government points the blame at California and the other way around. But that's just one point of sort of this long-running cycle of hardship in implementing Real ID.
Well, Brian, as I was just saying earlier, the DMV offices were going to be closed around the state for several hours on Wednesday to work on problems around Real ID. But these problems have been going on for a while. Is this too late, too little too late, would you say?
No.
Never too late.
If you have a deadline of October 1st, 2020, now is the time, because traffic's only going to get worse and worse at DMV offices as this deadline appears, because naturally human instinct is sometimes people tend to push things to the last minute. So you can have millions upon millions of customers flood these DMV offices over the next several months. So this is the DMV reacting to past problems, but this is also the DMV proactively trying to avoid future problems, because so far, only a few million customers have come in for Real IDs, and there's still about 20 million more people out there who need them. So things could get worse before they get better, and that's why the DMVs decided to close offices and take action.
Well, what about this other program that the DMV has gotten a lot of criticism for, and it's called Motor Voter? Remind us what that is and what happened during that rollout.
Sure. So Motor Voter is a program that was implemented in April of 2018 to automatically register eligible voters at California DMV field offices. And the purpose of this program is to boost participation and to boost turnout and sort of increase participation in the democratic process. That's the stated reason. But in effect, there's been lots of problems. There's been 105,000 registration errors that have occurred since the program's launch. And in some cases, people are being registered for the wrong party. If they're a Republican, they're being switched to no party preference in certain cases. We know of at least one confirmed case of a non-citizen being erroneously added to the voter rolls. So there's certainly a lot of questions concerning this program. And what I would point to really quickly is that there's two ongoing audits that are kind of looking into this Real ID Motor Voter issue that we should get some perspective about in the coming weeks.
All right. If you're just joining us now, we're speaking to Brian Anderson of the Sacramento Bee about the DMV's recent foibles. I want to get to the issue of wait times as well, Brian. They got so bad last summer that lawmakers had to get involved, and the DMV said that by the fall, wait times had gotten much more manageable. What about now? Where do things stand? Is that still the case?
Sure. Things are a lot better now than they were last summer. I don't think there's any question of that. What you see is the DMV providing monthly reports to California lawmakers over in the state legislature. And these monthly updates include a breakdown of wait times. So things based on that data are clearly getting a little bit better. Obviously, they're not quite where they want to be. The DMV always wants it to be going down and down. And I think the key thing for listeners is to make an appointment, because if you do, the average wait time is about 15 minutes across the state. And if you don't, it's about 45 minutes. So encouraging people to make these appointments is very important for people who want to avoid some of these long wait times. And it varies tremendously from office to office. So if you go to Napa, it could be 10 minutes, whereas if you go to a terrible part of LA, it could be 2 hours and 10 minutes. It just dramatically depends.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great to hear that the wait times have been reduced. But as we were mentioning, you still got the motor voter program and Real ID you've got to deal with. State lawmakers have been trying to figure out how to handle these kind of problems. And you've mentioned there were going to be audits. And meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom has formed a strike team to look into all these problems. Overall, do you think that a fire has been lit under Sacramento to get these issues taken care of ASAP?
Well, a lot has changed in the past year. We reported back in August, there was this initial effort to get an audit. And behind the scenes, former Governor Jerry Brown was urging lawmakers, at least one lawmaker, to not vote for this audit. And that audit request died effectively by one vote. And now you have a governor in Gavin Newsom who's proactively working in his first month in office. He created this strike team, which is expected to release its findings publicly around late July, early August. And there's also a place called Ernst & Young, which is conducting another audit and look into the DMV's problems of long wait times.
All right. Brian Anderson, who's been reporting on the DMV as political reporter for the Sacramento Bee, thank you so much for this update.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And don't forget to avoid those just don't go into the office Wednesday morning. They'll open up at 1 p.m.
And make those appointments.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Brian. If you travel in or around Ontario and Riverside, this next story is for you. A large section of the 60 Highway is going to be closed for 15 weekends, starting Friday at 10 p.m. That's the part that's between Riverside and Harupa that's going to be affected. There will be lane closures at night on other parts of the 60 also, between Ontario and Interstate 15, and that's starting tonight. One Caltrans official described it as bigger than Carmageddon. Do you remember that? That was in 2011 when the 405 shut down for a weekend, leading some folks to stay at home and avoid driving altogether. The project on the 60 Highway is part of a multi-million dollar plan to repave the roads and repaint the lanes. So in the meantime, fire up Waze on your phone, map out detours, and get ready, since this is the way it's going to be until the fall. Coming up on Take Two, MS-13, the mere mention of the gang's name can strike fear in Southern California. Recent news about seven grisly murders committed by gang members only boosts its notoriety. There was dismemberment involved, machetes. But there's this thing, too. Membership in MS-13 has been dropping in Southern California. What's going on? Stay with us for more Take Two, coming right up.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu. Back with more Take Two. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Last week, federal authorities announced charges against
22 suspected members of the notorious MS-13 gang. Included in their 12-count indictment, 7 brutal murders in Los Angeles committed against people who ran afoul of the group, including a homeless man who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Membership in the gang has dropped in recent years, according to the LAPD. Between 700 and 800 members are spread out among 20 or so cliques. Still, the Central American gang with LA roots continues to strike fears in the hearts of working-class immigrant neighborhoods. So how did MS-13 get started, and what fuels their violent acts? Let's talk to Stephen S. Dudley. He's the co-director of the research group Insight Crime and a longtime crime and public safety reporter. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stephen, I wanted to first start with the name MS-13. What does that stand for?
It stands for Mara Salvatrucha and the letter, the number 13, obviously, at the end. The Mara is a reference to, it was a way in which in Salvador, in El Salvador, for a long time, they described kind of bunches of kids, sort of unruly youth, if you will. And then the Salvatrucha, roughly translated, is this idea of being sort of street savvy. The 13 is a little bit more complex, but it is related to their larger relationship to what they call the Sureños, which is kind of an umbrella group of gangs that operates under the auspices of a criminal gang there in California called the Mexican Mafia. So that's the origin of its name.
Now, MS-13 is everywhere, has gained a foothold on the East Coast, but it has fabled roots in Los Angeles going back to the 80s. How did it start out there?
Well, it was a result of really kind of the wars that were happening in Central America, the war that really, you know, kind of hit LA, if you will, was the Salvadoran War. In particular, in El Salvador, there was a civil war that waged for about 11 years in the 1980s, and hundreds of thousands of people made their way to the United States. They were corralled, if you will, in marginal neighborhoods in places like Central LA or in the Valley, and they were subject to a lot of abuse and racism and the things that happened to immigrant groups. A lot of them were, had some experience and fighting experience, including in the war itself. Some military personnel were there, and also some guerrillas that had fought in the war, and they kind of formed the basis of this gang that evolved into what we know today.
And, you know, we're hearing that there's hundreds of members in L.A., so even though their numbers are apparently dipping, they have to recruit new members. What kind of folks are they looking for when they're recruiting?
It's a never-ending circle. It doesn't look that much different in terms of its recruitment than it did at the onset. These are, kids, mostly young teenagers, who are coming to the United States and moving into marginal neighborhoods, are facing difficult situations, you know, dysfunctional families, or they've been separated from their parents for years, or they're not living with anyone who is even a relative. And they go into these situations where they have to enter into our school systems, which are largely in many cases in disrepair. They don't have special programs for them, and they just feel more and more on the outside. And the types of groups that capture those types of people are very often gangs. They're sort of anti-social communities, if you will.
If you're just joining us now, I'm speaking with Stephen Dudley. He's currently writing a book about MS-13, set to come out next year, and he's been a longtime crime and public safety reporter. Stephen, the indictment for the alleged gang members operating in Los Angeles, when you read about it, it can be a little bit hard to stomach. I mean, it speaks of victims who are lured to remote locations only to be murdered. Some were beaten to death. Another man was dragged into the Angeles National Forest and hacked apart with machetes. Prosecutors say that the gang members then cut his heart out. I mean, gangs are known to be violent, but this seems to be next level. Why is MS-13 so violent?
Well, I don't think it's clear that they're any more violent than a lot of other gangs. I think what is clear is that they like to illustrate how much, you know, they take a lot of pride, if you will, in showing others that they are willing to take it to this next level, extracting this person's heart in this case, or use of blunt instruments such as machetes. This is what their brand is built around. And to a large extent, what this is, in many cases, are tests. They're tests of what they would call internally commitment. You know, what is your commitment to the gang? And this is what really kind of gives it cohesion, as opposed to sort of a strictly criminal group or a drug trafficking group whose end game is really to move drugs or other criminal activities. In the case of the gangs, their end game is really to strengthen their bonds, their internal bonds. They're a social group in a lot of ways, more than they are a criminal group. So this is part of this ritual of strengthening these bonds.
Mm-hmm. And through these violent shows, or shows of violence, they have become very notorious and a popular target for President Trump when it comes to security at the southern border. Studies have shown there is no actual causal link between illegal immigration and crime rates. But it's also worth noting that 19 of the 22 men being charged are in the country illegally. You know, the president's fix, border security, how does that fit at all? Would that make a difference in MS-13?
I really don't think it would. I think that this is really what the MS-13 represents is a perfect foil for the president to use this gang and conflate the gang with the actual immigrant communities in which it operates. They are victimizing those that are around them, that are in the areas where they live. You know, this is the victims themselves are very often mirror images of them, marginalized kids from dysfunctional or disjointed families. The efforts to stop them over what can be, you know, safely called a 40-year period have not been successful. And the efforts to mass incarcerate them have also not been successful. In fact, in many ways, it's been counterproductive. They've actually strengthened inside of their jail system, both inside the U.S. jail system and abroad. And efforts to deport them have led to them expanding to other countries. So far from being the solution, the sort of repressive efforts that Trump pushes, you know, they've actually ended up being counterproductive.
Stephen Dudley, he's co-director of Insight Crime and a longtime crime and public security reporter. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
More Take Two in a few moments. We're going to talk about the Bonnie and Clyde of LA that you haven't heard of. Stay tuned. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Speakeasies, mobsters, bootleggers. Los Angeles had its share of violent crime in the 1930s, including its very own version of Bonnie and Clyde. Author and historian Julia Bricklin chronicles the crime couple of Burma Adams and Tom White in her new book, Blonde Rattlesnake. And she stopped by in studio to discuss Adams' involvement with the crime spree that shook Los Angeles decades ago.
So during the spring and summer of 1933, this was the height of the Great Depression. It was a time of struggle. It was a time when people could no longer afford the basic necessities and they were looking for better times ahead. This was a pivotal moment in crime history too, because the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, Al Capone, there were any number of other gangsters who were being sought all over the country, including Bonnie and Clyde, who were still on the lam in 1933. This was before Prohibition had been repealed. So there was an undercurrent of crime coupled with alcohol. Burma Adams' life was pretty average and dull leading up to her age of 18 and 19 when she started her crime spree. She lived in Santa Ana, where her parents both worked two or three jobs apiece, and they had a pretty average life, all things considered. Burma Adams and Tom White met at a club in Culver City called Sebastian's Cotton Club. It was a jazz club. This was also a club that served alcohol. There, she went with a friend, so they went out on a group date, and that's where he swept her off her feet. During the couple's crime spree, I think what shocked California is the fact that Burma would not only drive the car for Tom and let him point a gun at innocent people, but that she seemed to be numb to the violence that he was doing, that she was sometimes laughing when he would say things to victims like, hurry up, give me your money, give me your money. The idea that a woman could be so wantonly callous toward victims and not even consider driving the car away and leaving him there for the police was just shocking. Over the course of about 5 weeks, they were not robbing banks. They were robbing ordinary people, and there was no rhyme or reason to it. And they really did travel throughout the whole city. I mean, there's reports that they were in South Los Angeles, Newport Beach, Redondo Beach, Manhattan Beach. So the whole Southland was terrified to drive. They thought at any moment they were going to be held up or even shot. So the fear was extremely palpable, but all told, it was about 25 victims. On September 4th, an LAPD squadron started what's called the dragnet, and they started stopping and frisking cars that contained couples that looked anything like Tom and Burma. But they had an idea that Tom and Burma might have been holed up somewhere around South Coronado Street. They set up a sting, and by, a couple of these policemen noticed that a blonde and what seemed to be her husband or boyfriend kept coming back to the same apartment building. So they waited until Burma drove a few feet into a filling station, and they purposely drove up behind her so she couldn't back out when she was done. One of the policemen said something to her, and when Burma turned around, they got a good look at her face, and they decided, yes, follow this woman back up to her apartment building and talk to her. Then they started questioning her, and Tom came down from his apartments. He pulled out a gun and started shooting at the police. The police shot him. Burma, meanwhile, had run to another portion of the flat where they lived and tried to jump out the window. We still don't know if she was trying to commit suicide or escape or something. But that really was the capture. That was when her husband was dead and she knew the game was up. She was sentenced to 30 years originally. The worst of her crimes was armed robbery, but ultimately she did 8 years. I believe the prosecution of Burma Adams White was the first time that Los Angeles set an example and said, Los Angeles is not going to be a place for criminals. We are not going to be chumps. And I think that Burma's legacy is to remember a time when Los Angeles and California in general said, we are not going to be the place for gangsters. We're going to stamp it out before it takes hold here.
That was author Julia Bricklin telling us about her book, Blonde Rattlesnake, and the crime couple who terrorized Southern California in the 1930s. Quite a good story there. All right, that's it for Take Two on this Monday. We loved having you join us. Come back tomorrow, and we'll talk to you then.